26th, 1995. Thank you, Brent. Greetings, Commander. I hope.
Here. In light. In love. You know, I'm weird. I love you. And I don't hesitate to tell you that. We have to remember what we are and how truly important it is, our family relationship. As we go through the days trying to survive, trying to do our jobs, we often lose sight of the fact of what we're about in reality. And these meetings were originally and still are for the necessary times that we need to come together to share. Because we don't have a group, we don't have an organization where there is a committee upon which to call at the drop of a hat. A lot of ones assume responsibilities, accept responsibilities, and you might want to turn this down, it's going to feedback. Is that okay? Can you still hear? Rick is off on probably one of the more incredibly important meetings that he's ever attended. Now that Shara is a little bit older, we're going to rely a lot more on Brent. It isn't that he's unwilling, it's that I have been unwilling to overload that situation. The babies are your most important asset commodity. And it doesn't hurt every now and then for you ones to get brought up sharp as to your responsibilities and what's really important. And that goes from Sandy and Jack having a new baby in a great deal of trouble to John, who's going to have to take responsibility for himself. That's why ones have come together, so that he can be independent in the period of time that he does not have his own things. That does not relieve him of the responsibility of attending his place, attending himself, and gradually, as can be arranged legally, to take back his responsibility. It isn't that he doesn't want it, it is that he's forgotten basically how to manage it. So he's not allowed the privilege anymore of having any of us as servants. And he must understand that. And if we are going to serve any of the group, and I have to use the term group because obviously there are several of you in this room and that constitutes a group. But no one is his but servant. And he thought that he had no assets. It doesn't matter whether he has assets or not. He has pension. He has income, Social Security, as it can be gotten back to him. And then, for goodness sake, they went ahead and rented out his property. And I want to talk about that just a minute. I want to put something into your corporate mind. It isn't as simple as them conjuring up papers, shifting over property out of Teja Corporation into the Eleanor Family Trust. That was never taken care of properly through the corporation of Teja, so it is not going to be honored. I'm giving you that legal advice. Plus the fact that Eleanor, if you will look at the list of joint property, has listed the house as joint property. So whether it's blundering error or whether they're angry at her or not, does not change the situation here. Ones need to go ahead and help John to see his way through. But if he cannot establish his own responsibility for both his dwelling, his property, whatever he is doing, then he has come no farther along than being in a place where they forcibly care for you. So everybody's going to have a lot of patience while John remembers and gains back his stamina. That will come along now, because he'll be eating better. He'll be intaking things that will sharpen up his mind. You have been deliberately dumbed down, all of you. And I'm not talking about cake over here on a Sunday. You can eat this every day of your life, and all you'll do is just get fat if you eat what you need otherwise. And that's very, very simple. And I had to come face to face with the fact that you ones are not always going to act in wisdom. And you almost lost a mother and a baby this week to septicemia. The bugs that they're putting out on you people act just like that. And you're carrying them in your system all the time. And loosed where they're not supposed to be in the body will do exactly what happened with Sandy. You'll get a toxic septicemia that can move right through to the baby. And it kills in a hurry. We must be ever cognizant of these things. There are things that I know you're going to want to talk about today, and I will entertain those subjects, but I'm not going to give you details for two reasons. One, we do not want to be the focus. Number two, I'm not going to give away your trade secrets. You're willing to do that and then complain because somebody else gets your product. If you're smart enough to always undersell everybody, you're going to be fine, and we'll be fine. But I'm not going to allow us to get into some quarrel with the FDA over anything that we want to call an antibiotic. Don't be silly. Don't even call it what they call it. And always, if it's possible to work with decent people with integrity in their own product, work with them. There are some things that you will not have, that you will not be able to get from somebody else, and that is our integration with the Drias. The Drias are the cell source of life. And you have to have monoatomic gold to fill and make whole that cell. It can be accomplished in other ways with colloidal silver, and especially if you can get some monoatomic gold in there. It's easy to produce. But they don't want you to have it on the market. But they can't make you take it off. They can only make you abide by the law and their regulations, which can hold you up for another year. And the way to do it is scattered throughout the literature. And when you have ones who come on the market with something like this, and it's a pre-1938 law, and they charge $40 for 4 ounces, I think it's obscene. I think it's obscene to charge $20 for 4 ounces where you can get it. Where else you know at this moment you can get it. I've already got it in the Gondriana. We can reduce through hydrogen peroxide what you need, and that can be mixed with hydrogen peroxide for the purification of water and getting into your system the amounts of silver and gold that you need just by dropping it on. Most of you are carrying around your little hydrogen peroxide bottle to purify your water. Don't quit doing that just because the water looks good. This way, in one glass of water, you can get all the silver and gold you need. You don't need great bunches of it. Great bunches of it will kill you. It's poison, heavy metal. But it's an inert metal. Lots of your visiting aliens are going to have a bluish tinge to their skin when they manifest in their human form. They'll look a little bit cyanotic, like they're not getting enough oxygen, because the silver protects, but it also causes the body to take on a kind of a luminescent blue tinge. These are not important, but I'm not going to allow us to sacrifice our product. And I had to come face to face with the fact that we had to have, and we must have, something to be able to use immediately as an antibiotic. While you can fight this back with your immune system, what you are being confronted with now are the overwhelming attacks that get you before your immune system can respond. So from time to time, you're going to have something. And as long as you live in this world of penicillin, etc., Dorma and EJ ran into an interesting situation. I sent them after, well, I just said we need some silver nitrate. So they go to, you know, Bob James says, well, there's BCGEF something, chemical company, and probably you can get it. Well, yeah, you can get it, a pound of the crystals, for well over $1,000. So, you know, they get 37 little, you know, a little 30-gram thing for a little over 100. These are the things where you need the intelligence of a Dr. Young, an engineer, a chemist. I don't need to tell you. I can tell her, and we'll make it just fine with what needs to be in the solution. But what you need is to do it properly so that it never is in question on your place. Never. And you don't want to make an accident and make something so toxic that its repercussions, although I do want to tell you this, that with colloidal silver, you're going to get a saturation of the colloid. And you can't overdose on it. And if it isn't brought right up to the full saturation point, it doesn't matter, because you have a large leeway in there where it will work. Now, this has not been used in so long, obviously since 1938, that the chemists, the head owner of this company, Mr. Eglund, didn't even know what EJ was talking about. And when he explained to Mr. Eglund, well, you know, this is one of the better ways of purification of water. And he said, my God, I thought we were trying to get all the heavy metals out. What are you talking about? Fascinated by the subject, see. How do you think you made it all of those thousands and thousands of years before penicillin? Penicillin just simply grows on bread. And you've built up resistant strains of everything against the antibiotics that they produce through the elite chemical companies. So I'm not going to sit up here and put out a tape that goes out to everybody who wants a copy of a tape and complains because they don't know what's going on and they want your product. I'm not going to tell you how to do that. on that tape. But it's mandatory that our people be able to get these things. And I don't want 1,000 people calling in and telling me where to get colloidal silver. I know where to get it. I know how to make it. What I want is something that is reasonably priced enough for people to be able to have it and safe without having to fight over the 1938 laws using lawyers. Forgive me, Gene. Except that I think Gene is probably more fed up with lawyers than we will ever think about being. So I'm in great appreciation for all visitors who come to share with us. But I was pretty rotten this morning as I wrote my lesson. Because as we try to be so damn entertaining, and Dharma's got to worry about the frosting on the cake, we have a job. And it doesn't include any of those things. And you're going to have to do them on your spare time. And she said, but I don't have any. And I said, right. And if I have to, I'll make it busier. That is not to be mean. That is so we don't lose sight of what we're about and fall into the trap of the adversary who will come to shut you down. I note that someone has produced this, that Paul Berger is, you know, he's sorry he hasn't gotten the last few contacts and are we still publishing, etc. Well, struggling along and maybe giving up gumdrops, we can still publish a paper. But I'm not feeling too friendly. I'm going to tell you a little story. This isn't to pick at Paul or Dale. But their information about the Phoenix Institute was wrong, incorrect, totally wrong. Not only did they present it incorrectly for themselves, but they were paid advisors to Betty Tutin, who took it to Sherry, and everything is all confused with the wrong idea about how the system worked. Well, if you're going to go out and sell a product, don't you try to find out what in the hell you're talking about? Isn't there a law that demands that you know what you're doing? Or you're out there giving fraudulent advice, especially if you're paid for it. But I have to back up. Because Paul met people when he was on a trek for the Phoenix Institute and contact and journals in Utah. He met someone who literally wanted a lot of information from me, personal and confidential. Knew where there were some hidden treasures and gold and stuff. And they only needed money. You know, then why are you coming to me? Well, isn't that what the Institute's about? Not that. No, thank you. So comes the lawyer's letter. But guess what? Betty Tutin's lawyer happens to be in Cedar City where Paul and Dale are. And the letter from the lawyer was filled with errors. That's fine. Betty wanted her money. She was going into a new venture. The Institute couldn't pay it. We were frozen still. By law, you cannot just go hand out the money. You are a corporate structure if you are involved with that at all. Just like Eleanor cannot come get out of Teja Corporation anything arbitrarily. Period. Her papers of no value. Well, it has John's signature. Well, John said he didn't put his signature on it, and it certainly is not reflected in the minutes or the resolutions or any other thing of Teja Corporation. Use your laws. That's why we've offered them to you, so that you know what you're doing and you can use them. And you're getting your confirmation, for goodness sakes, every day now. These shelters have been your protection. Sticks and stones might break your bones, EJ, but words really won't ever hurt you. Maybe he would like to give a report on how he did this dastardly deed to his leg. I know what he says now. I was out feeding your birds. Oh, well. Dorma's getting acquainted with her own baby parrots. There's not an inch of her that hasn't been bitten. So everybody's getting an experience. And this is what family's about, and this is why I need to visit with you as family. I'm tired of just giving lectures. You've grown beyond the pablum. You've got to learn what is God, and what is a hatton, and what is a you. And while we get to that, you've got to get through all of these day-to-day-to-day things that happen in life as a world crumbles. The biggie. I guess you must be going through some kind of a UFO barrage of some kind, because I'm asked all these questions. Have you ever been seen? Have you been, you know, all this stuff. Doesn't matter, but there are a few that you can mark your calendars on. There was one in 1976 at Mirbad, Iran. Not only were we there, we sent a shuttle ship. They sent up, can you believe, out of Iran, they sent up U.S. fighters to try to take us out. And this was a game. I want to tell you that we do have fun. We operate on thought, because that's all there is in this universe, my friends. And we can stand a plane off at 10 miles out, 14 miles out, whatever. And this is why I look forward to the day. You can shiver in your boots and everything. Oh, my God, they're going to. All I have to do is just turn off their power. And a fighter pilot can come up and do everything they can to pull the trigger on the gun and it won't fire. I've seen it happen. Over and over and over again. Or we let them fire. And if it's a heat-seeking missile, we'll send it right back. Man, they had to blow up the one out of Vandenberg because it was coming right back around and over to the atomic plant. We can abide your games. But yes, indeed, we are around. I think today what we need to do is have some just business. Gene has been to court. Gene can give us a nice report on John's status. And so let's start there. And then John asked for a moment, and then we can get on with the writing.
Got it turned on?
Already.
I want to comment first. John is looking fantastic. I had a talk with him this morning for a few minutes, and this is the first time I've really seen John since the time that he was really given some intensive treatment here. And I haven't been away for about 2 weeks, really noticed a tremendous improvement with John. Okay, yes. I had some time this morning after I combed my hair to do an overview of four or five different things. John Schofer, stop me when you get tired of listening. I was in court on Monday, I think it was March 19th, with Larry Cox and Mr. Falk. Larry Cox got there early, and I was able to buttonhole him. and do my best to feed him in on what I thought were going to be the important things that he should know. He was not particularly receptive to me. I could sense a certain withdrawal, but I kept following him around talking to him. And after we got into the courtroom, Mr. Falk was some 20 minutes late. Mr. Falk, in my opinion, he's the attorney that we hired for the divorce action. He was a total dud. But Mr. Cox took over and made it very clear to the court that he himself had been totally frustrated with working with Mr. Falk, and he wanted to take charge of the whole proceedings. And it was his impression that as a new conservator and the attorney for the new conservator coming into a case, that his job was to review the past conservators, find out where the inventory was, find out if the inventory as filed was accurate, find out where the assets were, and in particular locate the assets. And if the court didn't like that, to let him know right then, and he and his client, John O'Connor, were going to withdraw. It was an excellent tactic that he pulled with the court. The court was very responsive and says, no, 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 we don't want you to withdraw. We want you on the case. And that was a very effective maneuver by Mr. Cox, and I much, much appreciated that. And during his discussion, he raised the fact that where is John's Mercedes? Where is John's other personal properties? There's only been a very few things returned to John. And now we're informed that someone has gone out there, probably Rod McGroom, and rented the house. And this is all in violation of John O'Connell. John O'Connell's the conservator. Why is this happening? And he wanted some answers. And Commissioner Ryan, much to my complete surprise, she had been leaning forward. She put down her pen and pencil. She sat back in her chair. And she took up this issue of the Mercedes. And she says, where is this Mercedes? She says, I want to see this Mercedes parked in front of John's apartment. Why isn't it there? I think John needs that Mercedes for his recovery. It'll help him recovery. And he's entitled to have that parked right there in front of his apartment. And she then made an order at that time that the Mercedes be immediately returned. However, Mr. Gooden spoke up at that time. Right. I refer to him as Don Evil Eye Gooden. Evil Eye stood up, and Diane Gross was his wife was with him, and she was sitting a few paces behind him. I don't know if you've been to the courtroom or not, but there's a row of chairs on the side, so she was sitting back there. And I could just see the embarrassment in her face when Gooden stood up and expressed a few lies. Gooden's defense was, well, Your Honor, there has never been a court order signed that said that the house was the property of anybody but Eleanor. And she stopped him cold, and she said, wait a minute, Mr. Gooden, don't pull that on me. She says, you were in court here 2 or 3 weeks ago when the settlement was made in court and maybe was not reduced into a written form, but you stood right there, you heard the attorney stipulate, and you were part of this group, that the house, the community properties, the separate properties were going to be submitted to this court, and this court was going to have jurisdiction over those properties. And she said, you never objected to that, and don't you start objecting now, Mr. Gooden, to that position. However, Gooden continued to talk. I mean, this put him down pretty good. And about this time, I was sitting in the first row, and I was leaning forward, telling things to Falk. Falk had not even bothered to get the file out of his briefcase. He had his briefcase pointed at the floor. And
you were right the first time.
Right. So Cox, he had the case file in front of him. He was going through it. I told Falk that for him to get word to Larry Cox there to turn to the inventory item where Evil Eye Gooden had filed a report with the court admitting that the house was community property. And I said, also take a look at that transcript. Get Cox to take a look at the transcript where it states in writing that Gooden, Evil Eye Gooden, and Cox and John Mortimer were there, and they agreed that all the property would be put to the court. So Cox found those things, he held them up, and he read them to the court, and we were in a very commanding position at that time. Unfortunately, a few minutes later, both of our attorneys dropped the ball a little bit, and Evil Eye was able to gain several advantages, and if these would have been good trial attorneys, they would have stopped it cold. Evil Eye was able to withhold the court's order on the Mercedes until such time as he could check the mileage on the Mercedes, check the physical condition of the Mercedes, check and see whether or not there was insurance to enable the Mercedes to be driven down and who was going to drive it down. So he got a several week stay on the car being returned. But that car will be returned within the next couple of weeks. Evil Eye was able to, in discussing the renting of the house, he was able to get an order from the court that the parties remain in the house, that they provide certain information about who they were, what kind of assets they are, what kind of monthly payments they get to enable them to make payments in the house. We found out that the house payments are $600. We found out that there's only $600 been paid so far, which raises the question of the security deposits. It raises the question of first and last month. So evidently, these persons were placed in without those requirements. Evil Eye was able to get an order from the court that all monies collected from the rentals at this time be put into his own trust account. And I was able to talk with the attorneys, our two attorneys on the elevator way after we left the courtroom. I said, I sure as hell heck hope that you persons are not happy with the fact that they're going to go into Mr. Evil Eye's trust account. But we're going to change all that in the next few weeks. The purpose of the hearing was a motion filed by Evil Eye and Eleanor to terminate and get a complete whitewash of their conduct. That was the most important thing. Had the judge granted that, we might have not been able to go into all their misconduct. And Cox did stop that totally cold. We have a continuance of either 60 or 75 days for the purpose of allowing Cox to take extensive discovery, depositions, things like that, and he intends to start doing that right away to bring Rod into court, bring Eleanor into court, contempt orders into orders to show causes. And we are in a position now where we can fast find out what's happened to all these assets. Falk's last contribution was to stand up and ask the court again that all of these property, both separate community and everything, be handled within the jurisdiction of the conservatorship probate court. It was kind of a useless thing because the order had already been made but just not previously signed, and the judge reaffirmed that position. And it's important in another aspect because John Schroeper has just recently signed, I think this last week, an order allowing Falk to bifurcate the whole divorce proceedings. And once that's done, Falk's tenure there as an attorney is no longer needed. Everything will be within the control of the probate court, and Falk admits that he's not a probate expert. I don't think he's an expert in anything. But Cox seems to have something on the ball, and I think we can work with Cox. And Commissioner Ryan did make a slam at us, at which nobody responded to, and I really didn't appreciate. At some point when she's attacking Gooden and coming down on Gooden for his contravention of the order that he had been there and participated in, she made an offhand remark, Mr. Gooden, I'm not accusing your client of being involved in any misconduct. I still, despite everything that we have filed and placed in her, in front of her, the woman is still not convinced that we're not the bad guys and they're not the good guys. Okay, that pretty much covers the Schroeper thing, and from now on it's going to be in the hands of the CLC pushing Mr. Cox. We have very friendly relations with John O'Connell. John O'Connell basically does about everything we ask him to do. He's formed tremendous respect for all of us, and we have no problem working with him. Now, the next point I'd like to cover here, if I may, Commander, is the Ron Jackson. If I can bring everybody up to date on the Ron Jackson issue. Okay. Ron Jackson. Where does Ron Jackson start? Okay. Ron Jackson. At the present time, we don't know, I'm talking about the CLC, exactly what Ron Jackson has in mind or what his long-term plan is or his arrangement is. He appears to be on an agenda of his own. The situation is that the hearing on his writ of habeas corpus, that we, after we prepared the pleadings for him, sent the writ of habeas corpus and everything to him, the judge handled that in the most unusual manner. Originally, at the time of hearing, Ron Jackson was not present, and by all legal authorities, he should have been present. And at the time of the hearing, Rick and I had researched that law up to 1948, and that was the extent that we could research in the code books we had at the time. Since that time, I have researched the code books right up to the present date, and they all said that Ron Jackson should have been present at the hearing. Now, at this hearing, the trial judge failed to note that the opposition of the state had not been served upon Ron Jackson until the previous day. Ron Jackson never had an attempt to file an objection to the objection of the state. And that's required by law. He has to be given sufficient time to respond to their objection. That wasn't done. Now, then in the next situation is that the judge, a former public defender himself, and apparently that's the only area of practice that he has as a private attorney. He was working for the public defender's office. He should have never heard the case. He's only been a judge, I think, for a year and a half. And the basic rule is that if you've been a judge for less than 2 years and you come out of a particular office, that you should not hear anything involving that office until at least 2 years have expired. And that hadn't been done yet. He should not have heard the case. Thereafter, the judge relieved the present public defender, as he should have done for Ron's action, but instead of appointing a new attorney at that precise moment to defend Ron, the judge then turns to the very attorney that he's relieved and ask him if he has any further comments on the case on behalf of Ron. Totally ridiculous. All right. The public defender basically said, I can't comment, Your Honor. You've just relieved me, which is true. So at this hearing, the writ was denied. All right. Then the very next day, the same judge, without notice to anybody, brings Ron Jackson in, totally unprepared, totally without notice, totally without any notice to us or anybody else, and proceeds to cure or try to cure a lot of the errors that he made the previous day. He sits down with Ron and goes over the whole file. Judge never picks up the fact that he has two cases in front of him involving Ron Jackson, that the two are intertwined, and he makes the same mistake that had been previously made in this file and doesn't correct it at all. At his unannounced hearing, the judge wrongly evaluated the cases and reasons for the writ and suggested that Ron had filed in bad faith. This was not true. At the confusion of the sentencing judges, is clear in the two different proceedings, and that's right on the record, and Ron states right on the record, basically, I don't know what's coming off. I just had another, I think I'm supposed to be in another courtroom. I think I have a deal going with this other deputy DA, and here I am with this DA who doesn't know anything about anything. You know, Ron recognizes that there's something wrong. The court still hasn't picked that up. At this hearing, the judge suggested to the district attorney that they file perjury charges or contempt charges against Ron and that the case be continued for 1 week. If I had a good secretary here sitting next to me, I could have help on this page. To allow the DA a week to file some sort of a criminal charge against Ron Jackson. This was brought to my attention as I was traveling from one part of Nevada to another, hurrying to get there for this motion. But I was there in time to make a personal call to the district attorney after this and basically said, what are you and the judge doing in this particular case? Do you know that you're violating his constitutional rights to the worst extremes and all that? And we had a rather difficult argument between the two of us, but he assured me that he would be filing no further criminal actions against Ron Jackson. He was not going to participate in any type of an action being filed for perjury or contempt or anything else. But he did tell me that when Ron Jackson comes up for his parole hearings, that they do intend to send some sort of a letter to the parole board, which tells me that we have to give Ron Jackson a lot of help if he comes up for that parole hearing. Fortunately, I've been through that. I know how to handle parole hearings, and I know how to overcome some of the DA's objections of what I think he's going to do. At this point, we did extensive legal research, the CLC, into the ability of this judge to levy a fine against a person who had exercised his constitutional right to file a writ of habeas corpus. The writ of habeas corpus is one of the most protected things in our Constitution, and it's the thing that gives any person arrested the right to demand within a certain amount of time that they be brought before a judge and be explained why they're being wrongfully detained. I'm aware of the fact that there is a large movement in this country to try to restrict the use of that writ of habeas corpus, but when we get time, we should spend a lot of effort to try to defeat that movement. That's a strong constitutional right that we have to preserve.
We'll talk about that in a minute. Go ahead. Don't let us pass it by. You've got to face some facts.
All right. So with that knowledge, we prepared, the CL prepared and sent to Ron Jackson the necessary papers to be filed on his behalf to set this judge up and to set this order aside and to create the way for a constitutional challenge to the Supreme Court by the CLC. These are the type of issues we'd like to take to the Supreme Court. Now, when Rick and I sent these documents to Ron, we talked with Ron on the telephone and told him what was coming. We told him how important that these papers were. We told him what we intended to do with the papers. And by this time, we had acquired from the court all of the documents that we had ordered way back in December, which clearly set forth the confusion of the court and of the clerks, and which was not available to Ron at the original time of his hearing. There had been a terrible so-called lack of something or other, good performance on behalf of the clerks. I don't plan or unplanned, but we have them now. And they were a very important part of the things that we discussed and sent to Ron Jackson. Both Rick and I, after we talked with Ron on this telephone at this time, we suspected that Ron was not going to comply. We suspected that the vibrations we received from Ron told us that he had something else in mind. Anyway, I have constantly checked with the clerks of the Supreme Court. Like every 3 or 4 days, I call Shauna. I'm very friendly with Shauna, the Supreme Court clerk, and she checks for me to see whether or not Ron Jackson has filed the appeal of the denial of the writ. He has not done that. We got back to Ron. He gave us some excuse and said that he was going to get it done. We checked since that time. It still hasn't been filed. We got back to Ron again. He said, well, I'm going to send it in today. I'm going to have it delivered. And as late as last week, it was still not filed.